Called to order, it's 9:04, the date is May the 10th, and we do have a quorum to conduct business consisting of Senator French, Senator Stevens, and myself, McGuire, and we have five items on the agenda today. The first bill we'll take up is Senate Bill Number 151, New Driver's License Permit CPR. Next will be House Bill Number 132, Agriculture Day, then House Bill Number 159, Stillbirth Certificate, House Bill 75, Driver's License, Alcohol Awareness of a Minor, and then finally, House Bill Number 184, Motor Vehicles License Insurance. So without further ado, Senator Ellis.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Good morning.
For the record, I'm Johnny Ellis, representing downtown and midtown Anchorage in the State Senate, and I really appreciate you having this bill before you. I bring it before the State Affairs Committee at the request of the Kalinka family, a family that suffered a very needless, tragic event, a death in their family of their son, Eric Kalinka. The bill, in short, would require first-time driver's license applicants to complete some kind of CPR first aid training before obtaining their license. This would prepare Alaskans in the case of emergencies. And of course, we live in a state where we're prone to natural disaster. We live a very active lifestyle in the state, many of our residents. And so it makes all the sense in the world to me and to the Kalinka family and many others, first responders and health organizations, that we could take this very common sense step of requiring a CPR and first aid training, a very simple course for people in state for their first driver's license. When the stabbing happened that led to Mr. Kalinka's death, there were young people gathered around. No one knew what to do. The transcripts are heart-wrenching. The tapes are heart-wrenching about people wondering what to do and not knowing how to, taking some very simple steps that could have saved this young man's life. So we're trying to make something positive for the state's future and save some lives out of a very senseless tragedy. That's the bill in a nutshell. It's taken on a life of its own, Madam Chair, and I know time is short and we're near the end of the session, but many of the first responders and advocates, health groups, believe that we can, they've talked to enough people in the legislature that we could get this through the legislature this year, or I wouldn't bring it or be pressing, and I really appreciate your accommodation today to give it a shot to get through.
Absolutely.
And with that, my staffer, Kate Herring, is here to answer any questions, and appreciate your help.
Great, thank you very much. I've asked many of my own questions already prior, but do other members have questions at this time for Senator Ellis? Senator French?
Well, either for the senator or his staff.
Okay.
Have questions about the
how
it would work.
Okay. So I think Senator French is asking how it would play out, and that's what was explained to me.
For the record, this is Kate Herring, staff to Senator Ellis. Hopefully, Senator French, the chair, a young Alaskan, this wouldn't apply to folks coming in from the state who already have an out-of-state license. We wanted the state to kind of grow into this law. And also, Alaska has laws about how long you can be in the state before having to turn in your out-of-state license and get a new one. And that would present a conflict. You know, I could imagine somebody going up, just moving in from California and turning in his license, and they said, you know, well, you have to have CPR training. That could present a bit of a conflict. So it's just, we're talking about first-time applicants, and the basic idea is that they would have some kind of training or CPR. In talking with the Heart Association, it's their hope that this actually spurs more free sessions. It's something that they've been working on statewide, is training days where volunteers donate their time to train groups of people so that it wouldn't that would be a minimal cost. And then stakeholders would work with the Department of Motor Vehicles in order to develop regulations about how they would show the proof that they took some kind of training and whether that training was adequate. So a lot of it will be developed with the Department of Motor Vehicles.
So it can be a class.
So
or
it
online.
Can be. Yeah, it can be a class. It can be online. In your packets, I believe there's a study about the efficacy of short, self-guided training. We wanted to make this, open it up to a diverse range of trainings, so that we are not placing a huge financial burden or time burden on people, but the study shows that just a little bit of time spent on this topic could potentially save lives.
And Madam Chair, for the record, the bill or a concept has been before the legislature before. I co-sponsored with Senator Cowdery his bill in the last legislature that would have required school districts to offer CPR and first aid training as part of the school curriculum. Of course, we got a big outcry from across the state. The school districts resisted that, even though it's a good idea. They were vociferously opposed to the idea without and called it an unfunded mandate and meddling in school curricula. And so this is a simplified, stripped-down kind of approach that has gained support as opposed to opposition to this idea.
Senator French.
If I were to go out in the market today, if I had to go get a CPR class today, who would provide it and how much would it cost?
Well, it sounds, from my own, just kind of looking around through the chair, Senator French, you could, there are courses offered by the Heart Association, by the Red Cross, and by a couple other organizations. I've been told that when time is donated as far as training, the cost of supplies is about $5. But it looked like other training programs ran from about $20 to $40.
And if I can follow up, how many is it a 4-hour course now for CPR?
You know, I am not sure, but I think we have folks in the audience that could answer your question.
You got witnesses.
Yeah, we have witnesses.
And just to what we've been whispering about here is that the off-net line is plugged up because there are so many meetings going on. So the individuals, the fine individuals that you'd like to get on the phone are not here, but we do have someone from the Red Cross, and we do have Jenna App, I think, who could explain. I mean, you explained it to me very well, but whomever wants to pitch in here, because we don't have the off-net expertise that I know you were counting on. So is Shad?
Yes.
Okay, could you answer these kind of questions, do you think? Okay, wonderful. You could just put yourself on the record and fire away for Senator French here.
My name is Shad Ingletera. I'm with the American Red Cross of Alaska. I'm the Southeast Service Center Director, for the record. And basically, to answer your question, for the Red Cross, your adult CPR with AED class is 4.5 hours.
For CPR, and what about for first aid?
When you add first aid to that, that becomes a 6-hour class.
In total?
Yes.
In total.
So, and one of the things that the Red Cross classes teach is not just about CPR and first aid, but about how to react in an emergency. Mm-hmm. So we're very strong on, you know, it doesn't matter what the emergency is, but here are the steps you have to take to keep yourself safe and to keep others safe. You know, we don't want people going into a burning building or things like that. And that's part of the things that we talk about during a Red Cross class.
And so you've got a Resusa Annie, and you're doing the compressions and the breaths and everything, and so you're walking folks through how to do that.
Right, we're very hands-on. We believe that practicing the skills actually helps you do them, so you get your hand placement correct, and you don't have to worry about it when you get into emergency. You're going to do what you learned.
And they're always changing the compressions and the breaths. What's the current compression-breath ratio?
Currently it's 30 to 2, and they only change them once every 5 years.
Well, see, I'm getting older. That feels like all the time to me. Do you charge for that class?
I do charge for the class for the adult CPR. It's currently $42 per person. And then if you add first aid to it, it's an additional $20. So it's $62.
And is that offered statewide, Ketchikan to Barrow, Nome to Galena?
It's offered wherever we have instructors, so that's dependent on who. I know we have an instructor in Barrow that I can contact, and he's interested in teaching.
Good question.
Ketchikan, we have instructors. We are just now getting out into places like Wrangell and, or did we get Petersburg and Craig?
And Bethel, Barrow, Nome, Kotzebue?
I'm not sure about those because, again, I'm southeast.
I see.
So.
I see. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. And we do have Dwayne Bannock with the DMV on the line. But just on that point, don't leave for a sec here. Shad, so when I spoke with Jenna and others about this, my understanding then is that the law was crafted in such a way that you could complete a course such as you're describing, or you could complete an online course, and that would be considered sufficient to check the box and acceptable to the department to show them that you have that training. Is that your understanding?
From the two sessions that I've spent, yes.
Okay. And is it your belief that a person could reasonably understand CPR after doing an online course?
I haven't read the study, so I don't know what the study says, but from my experience, I know that people forget what they learn in one of our classes within 6 months.
Yep.
It's really interesting to have somebody come in and say, well, I just took this 6 months ago, and you go, so how many compressions to breaths is it? And
honestly,
they go, five
I've
and
forgotten,
one.
And I did all this, and I just did the infant stuff, and I don't...
So for me, it's really a skill, and like any skill, if you don't use it, you lose it. I talk about my languages when I talk about CPR. I used to speak Russian. I lived in Russia for 6 months, and I could speak Russian with the best of them, you know, talk philosophy and all. Now, if you ask me to say hello, I'm like,
Привет.
Yeah.
Привет.
And I have to be good. Как ваше дела? So, you know, like any skill, I believe you need to practice it and do it. But yeah. If the requirement of the bill is to have this 30-minute training, that's going to be obviously better than nothing, and especially in a state where you can drive 5 hours and see one vehicle. You know, you want that person to have some idea of what to do if you're in trouble.
Okay, thank you very much. All right, so we have further questions for Shed? Okay, we've got Dwayne Bannock online. Dwayne, are you there?
Good morning, Madam Chairman. Yes, I am.
Good morning. You're online to answer questions. My understanding is that this would be, this would be incorporated maybe into the training manual that teens are given as well. Is that accurate, that there might be a couple questions on first aid and CPR?
Senator McGuire, I think what we would probably be adding to the training manual would simply be the notification of this requirement, rather not trying to use the driver's handbook as the first aid handbook.
Okay. Okay. And then, so practically speaking then, I come in 16 years old, I take my test, I pass it, I bring that little slip up, I think that's the drill. Then I go out and take my driver's test. Then at what point in this process do I prove to you that I have taken a CPR and first aid class that qualifies?
More likely than not, the way this bill is crafted, I'll back you up just a couple of years to when you were 14 and you came in to get your learner's permit. As part of your application process, we envision one of two different things, a affidavit section on the application itself that would be signed by the parent, or a standard disclaimer, or I should say a standard affidavit form that is available, it'll be available in our offices or on our website, that perhaps Shad could sign off when you took that course, or your Boy Scout leader or Girl Scout leader, or your school class that taught it, or the fire department that taught it. Those types of outside classes, some sort of a document provided by them is what we envision. So it would happen at 14 when you get your permit, or if you were skipped that phase for one reason or another, which I don't really know how you could legitimately do, but I think that this is going to target mostly our younger people.
Okay, and then on that point, I got assurances that the immediate concern I had was over liability, and I thought, oh boy, this is just a lawsuit waiting to happen, because somebody's going to come in, they're going to affirm under penalty of perjury that they have taken this course, and then somebody's going to get in a pickle, and this person's going to be there, and they're going to use their skills and use them in a wrong way, or they're not going to use them. And then Jenna reminded me of the Good Samaritan law, which I think does protect you if you make that effort to help, that that you made that effort and it shouldn't be held against you if you do it wrong, but made your best attempt. But what about the person who does not help? And then I guess that goes back to the form. What are you envisioning by way of disclaimer?
Senator, the way I'm seeing it is that a course has been given to this particular applicant, training, or we'll probably use the language that's specific in here, that a first aid training in the 1 year period immediately prior to this has been taken. As far as you know, from a liability point, you're absolutely right, and I think you've nailed all the strong points of that argument. I just might add that we have a similar type of affidavit on young people for provisional driver's licenses, where the state statutes require that the young person has done 40 hours of driver training. And clearly we're not asking people to show us their logbooks with their times notated in it, but rather it is done by an affidavit. And we see that if that system has worked now successfully for going on 2 years, this system will as well.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's right. I think parents are going to be the key in that and making that good faith effort. And the kids pushing them all the way right up to the edge, too, because
right. It's
interesting what you can get kids to do when they want something. And that's the first point in my life I remember I wanted something bad enough that I was willing to jump through almost any hoop. Okay, so good. Questions for, we've got Gary, Dwayne Bannock with the DMV. So, Senator Stevens.
Yeah, hi, Dwayne. Is this an unusual thing? Is there anything else that you do out of the ordinary? I mean, we're talking about getting a driver's license. Is there anything, any other requirements that we have on people to get driver's licenses really beyond driving? Are there other states that have any requirements similar to
If I may, Senator, good morning to you. Through the chair, Senator Stevens, that's a very good question. I can only tell you that there's criticism of the Division of Motor Vehicles and our affiliation with organ and tissue donation. How does that have anything to do with driving? Well, you're not necessarily tested on it, but it is universally accepted that Division of Motor Vehicles branch out into that field. Division of Motor Vehicles are also responsible for a lot of elections. Again, not necessarily part of your driver's license, but that's what we do. I could go on into that realm. I will tell you that perhaps in the next several minutes, you're going to be hearing another bill that has a similar to this question that you've asked me about branching out driver's licensing and quite frankly, both of these components that we're going to be talking about today come from an educational background. I'm here to tell you, and I would believe that you'd concur with this, the more education that we have is probably not a bad thing.
Further questions?
Don't put me on the spot on that one. The question is, are there other states that do anything like this, and are we doing anything like this in other areas? You say organ tissue donation, but we don't deny a license if you don't donate your organs, do we?
Senator, that is correct. I apologize if
I wish we could
went off the topic there. Yeah. I'm not familiar if there's another state that does it or not. I've not researched that question.
Well, I guess I just have to, I mean, I realize this is not your bill, but it just concerns me that how far are we going to go on this? What are we going to require? I'd like to just have everyone know Alaska history. We're going to require you to do that before you get a driver's license. My heart goes out to the people who've had this problem, but should we say then that that everyone should have to spend an additional money, additional time in order to get a driver's license, and we're holding this over kids' heads, when in fact the issue is, what are you going to get if you get a driver's license? I have some qualms about this, and I just want the chairman to know that.
So noted. Senator French.
Good morning, Mr. Bannock. My question is, what is the cost to get a driver's license for a 16-year-old getting their driver's license? What's the total price tag for the road test and the license?
Good morning, Senator French. Through the chair, the cost of the actual license itself is $20. The state of Alaska provides road exams for $15. However, road exams are also available through private for-profit vendors that has a varying price.
So for a 16-year-old, the price tag is $35, though, kind of as a minimum.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Okay, interesting. I didn't know road exams were offered through private industry now. Further questions for Dwayne Bannock at the DMV? Okay, hearing and seeing none. Anybody else online yet from the Heart Association? We were okay. Do you guys, is there anybody else you want to? Okay. Okay, so anybody else in the audience that I've overlooked? Anybody online? Okay, hearing and seeing none, it brings Senate Bill number 151 back before us for committee discussion.
I guess I have to share. I share some of Senator Stevens's concerns as the proud owner of an 18-year-old who is thoroughly immune to the charms of government, regulation, taxes, and other forms of authority. I can just hear his rant when I tell him about this bill that I've now told him that he has to not only get a road test, get a driver's license, and everything else, has to go take a 6-hour CPR and first aid course. And he, of course, is grandfathered under the bill. He already has a driver's license. But it's a fairly significant imposition. I totally agree it's necessary. I totally agree it's a good idea. It'd be nice if everybody knew first aid. You can save lives with first aid. But I have a little bit of a hesitation about whether this is the appropriate place to put up that roadblock for all 16-year-olds.
Senator Green, welcome. Good morning. We have Senate Bill number 151 in front of us from Senator Ellis. And we have heard from folks with the Red Cross and the DMV. This is requiring brand new applicants for a driver's license. So the folks that are 13, about to become 14, I guess, really, to take a CPR class. Did anyone answer the question about how long the online class is? Does anyone know? Do you know, Kate? If that's
for the record, Kate Herring, Senator McGuire, I'm hesitant to answer just because I know that people that were supposed to call in had more in-depth answers, like whether it existed in other states and how long the online classes were. We had somebody from the Heart Association who I think was the font of knowledge on those topics. So if they're not, we're unable to call in,
Senator Ellis, would you be amenable to rolling this down just a little bit until they get online? Since there seems to be a little bit of angst to have those questions answered by the committee. So we'll just stay here and keep meeting. And then if we could, the minute that individual pops up online, I can set aside whatever we're working on, bring it back up again. Okay, why don't we do that? Okay, fabulous. All right, so we'll set Senate Bill number 151 to the side, and we'll go next to House Bill number 132 that's on the schedule by Representative Gatto. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. In the interest of abbreviating things, of course, if the bill asks that we dedicate the first Tuesday in May as Agriculture Day, and the impetus behind it is to say we have a $50 million industry and a lot of the kids in the schools probably know little about it, and this gives an opportunity in the elementary schools to dedicate a day when we maybe can deal with those issues. It's at the right time of the year to do it. And unfortunately, I think in the news this morning was that the director of agriculture has resigned. And I said, oh, brother, and the bill comes up today. This is scary.
It's the second Thursday in May, is that?
Yeah. I was going to ask you about that, if you wanted to change the date.
First Tuesday?
Yeah, we were just wondering.
Thank you, sir.
The first Tuesday's already passed, so we didn't know if this is something you were trying to get done in time for this year or whether you were going to let this go through and then wait and celebrate next year.
We're going to celebrate it this year no matter what. Okay. This has got to be for, I think, so we don't have to come back each year and try to make it for the next year and the next year and the next year.
Okay, so just clarifying that point then, so you do, Representative Gatto, want to keep on line 5 the first Tuesday in each May, or would you like to put it to the third Tuesday so you can celebrate it this year or
no, it's all right.
Not? Okay. Okay, consider Agriculture Day celebrated already. Okay, so the idea is to get young people involved and aware of what agriculture means to the state.
I think this is where schools have projects and they say, school lets out in a while, and let's start seed sometime earlier so that by the time school actually lets out, they get to process plants and they get to bring them home, put them in the ground, and have some understanding of a food crop, that everything doesn't come packed in plastic and originating in a grocery store.
Okay. Questions for the bill's sponsor, Representative Gatto? Senator Green?
No, I have no questions.
This is your district.
But you'll notice she's wearing agricultural motif.
There's nobody here to testify, right? Anybody here in the audience for House Bill number 132? Didn't see anyone. Anyone online? Okay, so that brings the bill back before us, Senator Green.
I would move HB 132 out of committee with individual recommendations and accompanying zero fiscal cuts.
Okay, Agricultural Day has moved House Bill 132. That brings us to House Bill number 159 by Representative Carl Gatto.
And I just happen to be sitting right here in the chair.
Yes, we planned it this way.
159 is so near and dear to my heart, arguably my favorite bill, because usually it's so valuable to people. I've heard from people that have had stillborn children decades ago who are writing letters to me now and saying, thank you, thank you, thank you. And you say, of what value is having a certificate of birth resulting in stillbirth when you already have what's called a fetal death certificate? And I'll tell you, I probably don't need to tell you, but I'll state it anyway, that it's very difficult for a mom to leave a hospital expecting to go home with a baby and instead going home with only a death certificate. In fact, it's absolutely crushing. And what this allows a mom to do is say, this certificate recognizes that I carried a live baby for a certain amount of time, and I'm sad that I lost it, but it did happen.
Yep, and my understanding is this is completely optional for a parent. They're not required to have it. If, however they heal with that traumatic loss, they can choose so. And if it's through a death certificate, it is. But for the families and the women who this brings closure to, this is an option for them.
We may never get closure, but, you know,
yeah.
Every little bit of recognition. And it's got to be a fearful thing to bring an urn home instead of a baby.
I watched a home improvement. You know, they go out and pick families, and one of the women had lost her first child, and as part of the room that they did for her, they did a whole case with the little booties and the take-home outfit and things that she had, and that was for her. She had expressed her voice similar feelings, that there was just a sense of, you know, it was her first child, and she was so excited, and they had no idea. Went into the delivery room expecting everything to be well. So it is a very traumatic event. Questions for the
bill? Point up. The things that were instructive for me in this bill was, can this be used to get a permanent fund dividend? No, it can't. Can this be used to for an inheritance? No, it can't. On the bottom of the certificate, it clearly states this is not a certificate of birth.
Yeah.
And I think that we needed that in there. We looked through all the states to come up with the best possible certificate, the ones that had 5 stars that were definitely not argued against. And what we have now is, I think, a 5-star certificate.
Yeah.
Could we have a brief of these?
Yes, brief of these. We're back in order. We still have the matter of House Bill number 159 before us, and we do have two individuals that have called in just online. If I could, with your leave, go to them. Okay, so in Kenai, we have Rhonda Crawford. Rhonda, are you there?
I am.
Okay, please go ahead and state your name for the record, if you have any affiliation or if it's just yourself, and then offer your testimony.
No affiliation. I'm just here personally. My name is Rhonda Crawford, and I'm from Kenai. And trying to make it through this. On October 27th, I went in for a checkup, and my baby was fine. I was a little over 39 weeks. On 2 days later, I went to the hospital for another routine checkup, and there was no heartbeat. So I chose to have a C-section. That night, I was woken up by a nurse at 4:30 in the morning who told me I had to fill out an application for a death certificate, and I had to decide what to do with the body because there was no cold storage in our local hospital. By 9:30 the next morning, they let me hold her. She was beautiful. Physically, nothing wrong with this baby. 8 pounds, 4 ounces, dark curly hair. I got 5 minutes with her. It was very devastating to my husband and my family. We couldn't tell our children because my oldest son's birthday was that day and we didn't want to ruin it for him. As far as he knew, I was in the hospital just for testing and everything was fine. After we were given, first we were given the application actually for a birth certificate, and a few minutes later the nurse came back in and said, oops, sorry, wrong one. We need you to fill out a death certificate. It was like a slap in the face. It's such a simple form. It costs nothing for the state of Alaska. It would mean so much for families that have suffered this loss. You walk out of the hospital with nothing. I walked out of the hospital with footprints, with her gown, a lock over her hair, and the hospital bracelets that she was wearing. I got to go home and clean out the diaper bag and take down the crib. And having this form, being able to go to the courthouse and pick up a form that acknowledged that she existed to me and my family, even if just for a short time, would mean so much. And I have a very good friend that this happened to almost 20 years, and she was very excited that she might be able to get the form as well. So I want to thank you for changing the language that will allow parents to seek a birth certificate resulting in stillbirth instead of just a death certificate. The experience itself is so negative. It's all about loss. So having this form will give some acknowledgement that these children existed to their families, even if for a short time. So that's it. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Rhonda, for your testimony. Ms. Joanne, Cacciatore.
Yes, hi. Joanne Cacciatore, yes. It's a difficult last name.
I really butchered that one. I am so sorry.
That's okay. It's Cacciatore, just like the Italian food.
And Carl's looking at me as the Italian over here. So you really...
Yes, indeed.
If you could just put... And you are an MS...
I'm an MSW, and I'm also a PhD candidate.
Okay. Wonderful. Just offer your testimony.
Certainly. Hi. Thank you very much for having me. First of all, my sympathy to Ms. Crawford. It's an absolute, unbelievably painful and traumatic experience to give birth to a dead baby. And Rhonda, thank you for your courage and for your really moving story. And thank you to Senator Grotto for bringing this attention to lawmakers and policymakers in Alaska. I'm moved by the compassion of this committee as I've been listening to some of the discussion. Thank you all for your compassion. It is apparent to me that at least from the dialogue that I've heard, people understand that this is a really difficult situation for families and that this is important. My name is Joanne Cacciatore. My entire PhD candidacy has focused on the research that I do, which is on women and families who have experienced stillbirth. I've studied in a recent mom study more than 5,000 women who've experienced the death of a baby to stillbirth. I'm also the CEO and founder of the MIS Foundation, an international nonprofit agency that started this movement back in 2001 in my own home state of Arizona, where we first passed the bill. Since then, it's passed in nearly 20 other states. The reason that I got involved in this is because in 1994, my fourth child died 15 minutes before she was born on her due date. Much like Rhonda's story, my daughter was perfect. She was 8 pounds, 21 inches. A postmortem evaluation revealed nothing as the cause of death. And I left the hospital with a little plastic teddy bear after 10 months of pregnancy and enduring grueling hours of labor and childbirth. My three children were affected significantly by this loss to this day. Now my children are 21, 18, 16, and I have a subsequent child at 10. And they are still affected by this loss. This is such an important piece of legislation for these families. It's so simple. The states tell families you must have a death certificate and you must pay for final disposition through cremation or burial. For a baby, they never say existed. How can you be born? How can you die if you were never born? And that's what this comes down to for the families. It's a basic philosophical, psychological piece of comfort and dignity for women and their families. These women gave birth just like every other woman. They have endured childbirth just like any other woman. They've invested emotionally, physically, and financially in this baby. And this is something that we see in terms of this desire. This is something that we see worldwide. Ireland issues birth certificates. The UK issues birth certificates. Australia issues birth certificates. Many other countries issue birth certificates for babies who are stillborn. I'm not sure why this is a fairly recent movement here in the United States, and that's certainly not what the foundation is all about, but it is a small but important piece of what we do. Our entire goal is to provide comfort and emergency and long-term services to families when a child dies at any age and from any cause. In fact, our website gets 1.5 million hits a month, and we have 76 chapters around the world. We offer a variety of services for these families. So I'm deeply immersed in the stories and the narratives of these families and their angst, of which about 50% are families who've experienced stillbirth, because 1 in 100 families will experience the death of a baby because of stillbirth. I thank you for your time. I thank you for your consideration. I'm very well informed about all the issues, and any questions that you might have, I would be more than happy to address.
Thank you very much, Joanne, and Rhonda as well. And there isn't a dry eye in the room if we're not on camera today, but your testimony, Rhonda, was very touching, and I think hits at the heart for a lot of people. I just had a son last year, and he was born and actually turned blue, and we thought we might have lost him too. So I think a lot of women experience that as well, which is that right to the edge feeling that very thing could happen to you, and it's devastating. It's devastating. So anything that we can do as a state to help make this process less painful for a family, I think is incumbent upon us. So
thank you.
Any further testimony here in the audience? Anybody online? Okay. Hearing and seeing none, that brings House Bill 159 back before us. Committee discussion? Got a motion?
I move House Bill 159 from committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
Okay, so that's the motion. Any objection? Okay, hearing and seeing none, House Bill number 159 has moved. Thank you very much, Representative Gatto.
Thank you.
Okay, next. Let's ratchet down the emotion here today and get down to something like alcohol awareness. House Bill number 75? Nope. Okay, moving on. Oh, she is here. Okay. Okay.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Good morning.
For the record, I'm Barbara Cotting, staff to Representative Ramirez, who I don't see at the moment. And I believe Duane Manick is online still for this bill. This represents a continuing effort on the part of Representative Ramirez to improve alcohol awareness in the state. It stipulates that a driver's license issued to a person under 21 years of age will expire 90 days after the person turns 21. It further requires that a person applying for a new license after expiration upon turning 21 must pass a test relating to alcohol and drug awareness and safety before receiving the new license. The test will be designed by the Division of Motor Vehicles, and Representative Ramris hopes that Mothers Against Drunk Drivers will participate in the process. They're supportive of this bill. The interesting part of this that really does make a difference is that the license for the person over 21 and under 21 will look very different, and I believe in your packets you should have at the back a color copy of how the two licenses will look different. Actually, one is horizontal and one is vertical, and Representative Ramris had a sample of the minor's license with the Mickey Mouse. Did you all get those?
Yes.
Yay. Thanks.
In this packet, yeah.
I actually have the original of that, too, as a sample. The license for the person over 21 will look totally different from the one for the person under 21, and this should make it way easier for retail clerks and on-premise servers to detect minors from adults. And the hope is that this will make a significant reduction in underage drinking in Alaska, which is really the goal of it. Now, in your packet also, we have some sample questions from Duane Bannock at the DMV that are already on the existing test. I marked it sample test questions from DMV. And it's interesting, these are already on tests. I didn't know the answers. I still don't know the answers to some of these, but they all have to do with alcohol awareness, drunk driving awareness, the penalties. There's even one interesting one about how do you sober up after drinking? And I don't know if the answer is none of these or what, but they're interesting questions to look at. Also, you have a CS in your packets that I put at the top at the request of Duane Bannock, DMV. The CS adds an effective date of January 1, 2008. Okay. And there is a small fiscal note, I believe it's $5,000, one-time charge just to initiate the process, and then there's a zero after that.
So does this bill have a finance referral?
Yes, it does.
Okay. Boy, our young people are going to be doing a lot to get their license, aren't they, if we have our way today here. Okay, questions for the bill sponsor's representative. Okay, there are two folks online. Oh, Senator Green.
So there's no test when you get your first license.
Oh, yes, they have to pass a test, a driving test.
No, I mean no alcohol awareness test at the first license.
No, not currently. Not that I know of. Mr. Bannock can answer that.
Mr. Bannock, you're online for this to answer questions. Senator Green has asked, are there already questions about alcohol when you take your first test at 16?
Good morning again. Through the chair, Senator Green, there are questions in our knowledge test that are specific to the laws of drinking and driving, the reinstatement, what happens, what the minimum blood alcohol count, et cetera, et cetera. Those are incorporated into our knowledge test today, ma'am.
But not to the extent that they are if you turn 21.
Through the chair, Senator Green, perhaps if I can explain it this way, and I've spent some good time having discussion with the bill sponsor on this concept. There's two things that would take place with HB 75 that are different than today. Number one is it would create its own separate test at a different time than when most people take the knowledge test. Most people, as I testified earlier, take the knowledge test when they're 14 years old, when they get a instruction permit. This now creates a second test at the expiration of your driver's license when you turn 21. So when you become 21, you would take this test. And we've envisioned that this is certainly a test that we want to create in conjunction with the Department of Health, utilizing some of their expertise in what is the message that we need to be testing these now 21-year-old people on.
Okay. Further questions for Mr. Bannock? Senator French.
Thanks, and same question as before with respect to the cost. What would the cost be for the post-21 test and driver's license?
Senator French, we have to go down the road that the 21-year-old already has a valid driver's license, so they've already paid for their skills test or their actual driving test. We would treat this the same way we treat the provisional driver's license, in that it's a $15 duplicate license fee, $15.
And no charge for the test itself?
Senator, through the chair, correct.
And where would the young person get the information necessary to pass the test? Would there be a booklet, or would there be a study course, or where would the information be assembled, and who would assemble that?
Through the chair, Senator French, we've been in discussion with the Department of Health on that point. I don't believe that it's necessarily proper that the Division of Motor Vehicle be responsible for teaching or necessarily providing this information. I think it's appropriate that we be the distribution point. If there is a booklet or a pamphlet or something like that that's manufactured, but for the same reason that we don't teach people how to drive, I don't know that it's appropriate that we actually teach them the effects of the alcohol on their bodies, sir.
Okay, we do have the bill sponsor in the room, Representative Ramirez. You want to come up where your staff has given an overview, and the committee members are in the process of asking questions. And there is a CS, and my understanding is you'd prefer to not have that adopted today and go back to the original bill. So if members would just go back to /K, that'll be the bill we're working off of. And so are there questions for the bill's sponsor?
I have one.
Senator Green.
What about the person that moves into the state that is 47? Do they go through this same testing?
Through the chair, Madam President, Senator Green, no, this is just for 21-year-olds who are going through that seminal gate of merging the responsibility with making the decision to drink and consume an alcoholic beverage. So it does not apply to people over the age of 21 or people moving into the state over the age of 21.
Okay, further questions, Senator French.
How about folks, 21-year-olds in the military out of state or college students out of state, what's the effect on their ability to get a license or keep a license?
Through the chair, thank you, Senator French. This is something we've worked on with Director Bannock and the DMV. Through regulation, they already have this addressed as it relates to driver's licenses that would expire for people that are in the military or in college out of state, and the director would better speak to that regulation, but that was addressed.
Okay, Mr. Bannock, could you respond to Senator French's question?
Thank you. Through the chair, Senator French, there is a regulation that is very clear as it pertains to active duty military personnel. Their driver's licenses have no expiration date. When they are outside of the state of Alaska, the license will expire 90 days after returning to the state or after separating from active duty service, whichever comes first.
And how about those college students?
We offer a program. We have statutory authority to offer an extension program, and we do that quite frequently today. A college student will have their driver's license expire while they are perhaps out of state, and it's not just limited to college students. The statutes are clear that we are to develop a extension program, and the only the military one is defined by the time, that it's basically unlimited. We treat our extension programs in blocks of 1 year, and it can be everything from, I had a customer the other day that was in a hospital out of state receiving medical care, and her driver's license had expired, and we issued an extension letter and forwarded it to her.
Okay, further questions for either the bill sponsor or Mr. Bannock? Senator French.
I guess I'm still a little bit unclear as to who is going to sort of seize the reins here and develop the class. Mr. Bannock has said he doesn't think it's his department's responsibility to do so, and I guess I can't disagree. Their you know, mission in life is to issue driver's licenses and keep track of them. And so I'm not certain who is there. A state official is going to be in charge? Is it a bureaucrat? Is it a private enterprise? Who gets the mission if we pass this law?
Through the chair, Senator French, Director Bannock may have already gone over the present general knowledge test, 1,000 questions in the pool, 16 questions, 8 on driving, 4 on insurance, 4 on alcohol. This second test, we would be very comfortable for Department of Public Safety and Mothers Against Drunk Drivers to put this test together, very likely under the direction of the Department of Motor Vehicles. I think ultimately, since they are going to be conducting the test, it should pass merit with them. But I think there are plenty of folks in DPS and Mothers Against Drunk Drivers that can work on that, or simply generate the test from the pool of questions of the 1,000 that relate to alcohol.
Okay, and maybe you want to talk for a minute about your policy goals, the passion behind it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two objectives. One is that we think this is creates a brighter line between minors and adults. As you know, the ABC Board has conducted these extensive stings for the last few years, and there are plenty of opinions about the appropriateness of these stings, but one thing that they have shown us absolutely is that there's a leakage rate amongst minors being served in on-premise and off-premise establishments. And I believe, we think that...
Could I just ask, that's a term I'm not familiar with, and I see it in your documents, and so maybe you can just explain to those of us who don't work in the industry what leakage rate means.
Thank you, through the chair. Senator French, I don't think it's a term, I don't think it's an industry term. It's just a word that I simply put to it when I looked at these statistics, and I thought, are there really this many operators on-premise and off-premise that are really trying to meet their mortgage payment by serving minors, or do we simply just have this pool of 21 to 25 year olds who are going into a retail establishments on-premise and off-premise with minors, bless you, with minors driver's licenses, and are either being predators or are being mistakenly served. And so my thinking is that by requiring the automatic expiration of a driver's license at age 21 and then allowing this 90-day grace period because of the legalities and the requirements for the DMV that surround it, is that it shifts the relationship of who the predator is in trying to purchase an alcoholic beverage, because it's often the minor that just wants something before they are legally allowed to have it. And yes, ma'am.
So just so I'm clear, the predator is let's just say a 20-year-old has a license, his or her own license that identifies themselves as being 20, mm-hmm. but they're presenting that to a bar bouncer or a bartender and using that without the person actually checking it. Is that what we're calling them, the predator?
I would say any young person under the legal age that tries to secure an alcoholic beverage is a predator. And any licensee who tries to sell an alcoholic beverage is a predator. And so in this case, because identification is being used, then presumably it's the minor that is the predator, because they're presenting a driver's license. And so I'm interested in creating a brighter line between minors and adults. A real life scenario would be that in an establishment that I have that serves liquor licenses, if your license ran vertical, you would not be able to purchase a drink without really having to lean over the bar and prove that your birth date was 13 days ago. Whereas right now you have across the state thousands of bartenders and servers who are making split decisions.
Glancing at a license, yeah. Saying okay, without really being able to bear right. down and look at the date because of the lighting or the rush
lighting,
or whatever else.
The speed, the point size. I mean, look at the point size that we ordinarily work with, and the point size of the birth date on a driver's license is remarkably small. And this will draw so the first half of this bill really draws a much brighter, clearer line between a minor and adult, with the automatic expiration component.
Yeah.
And the second component is if we're going to take them to the DMV for the expiration of a license, why don't we educate them more about the perils of consuming alcohol. Although a lot of our traffic fatalities are linked to drunk driving incidents, there are a great many more drunk driving incidents that are related to that minor or young adult getting home safely or getting a DUI. It's happening, you know, for every vehicular accident, it's a drunk driving incident that goes unreported, undetected, is happening, you know, an exponentially greater ratio. And so the notion of conducting a test and doing and adding an education component for these young people is that maybe we can catch some fraction of these 21-year-olds as they go through this seminal period in their life where alcohol is merging with the responsibility of driving, and get them to incorporate different adult habits, the ones that are desirable to all of us in government and public service, rather than the very random manner in which we're educating our youth right now. A general knowledge test at age 14, a skills test at age 16, some random testing or random education throughout high school, some public service announcements on television, some Budweiser posters that at the bottom say drink responsibly. There is really no effective means of disseminating information about the perils of drunk driving. And it's not just the vehicular accident component, it's also the cost to these young people that are getting DUIs. If you look at their discretionary income that they have and the vocational pursuits that they are boxed out of, if they get a DUI at age 21 or 22, and that's going to cost them $20,000-$30,000 by the time that they've gone through this this five-year period, it's I think it's in our best interest for the safety of our communities and for the safety of these young people and for these young people staying on a right road to consider both halves of these bills. The automatic expiration of the license to draw a clearer line for the purchase of and the retail and the on-premise component, and secondly, to educate them so that they are better advised when they make that decision to consume an alcoholic beverage and drive, or to consume multiple alcoholic beverages and drives, which is the illegal act that proportionately young people, they don't vote and they drink and drive. I mean, that's, you know, the profile of young people.
Kate, Senator Bundy has joined us. Senator French.
Just to follow up, and I completely agree with the impulse behind the bill. Obviously anything you do to reduce DWI does not only save huge amounts of money, but it saves lives, and so you can't be opposed to that. And I guess I kind of like the idea of the landscape versus portrait driver's license as a quick check. I've done some volunteer work as a bouncer at the beer garden in Girdwood, which collects money for charity. People come, you know, during the forest fair, and you work at the gate, and it's kind of fun. You talk to a lot of people, and it's hard to glance at a driver's license and tell right away if you're over or under, and the landscape portrait would make it real easy. The only caveat I had about the class is, you know, I guess you'd want to see some evidence that it works. We're always trying to find things that work, and I guess the one observation I'd make was that there was the DARE program that really sounded good. Have cops go into classrooms and talk to kids and kind of scare them a little bit. And, you know, we all got behind it. It sounded good. And after a couple of years, you studied it and found out it made zero difference whatsoever on the effect of, on the behavior of kids. And so I'd want to get some evidence that, you know, pushing a few buttons inside a crowded DMV facility on a test screen changes behavior and justifies the cost. I totally support the impulse. I'm totally behind the idea. I just have a little trouble being confident that it's going to make a difference. Thank you.
And one thing I'd recommend, Representative Remmers, I know it has a finance referral, is the part, I agree with everything that Senator French said, and frankly everything that you've said. The missing part for me is the detail about what test it will be, what it will look like, and how it will be administered. So that appears to be the missing link in it. You said Department of Public Safety and MAD would be willing to do it, but if you think about your presentation to other members, you might want to think about cinching that part up, what it will cost, what it will look like, will it be effective based on what evidence, do other states do it, and then maybe having someone from DPS or MAD to talk about that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think those are excellent suggestions. So we do envision it being incorporated into the DMV book, and actually going into more detail. Since the general knowledge test is designed so that a 14-year-old can pass it, because it's administered to 14-year-olds, we think that this will help to institutionalize the dissemination of more knowledge. And what we have heard in previous testimony on the House side, I think from Representative Roses, was that when he was in the classroom, kids may carry their math book, they may carry their science book, they may carry their French book, but by God, when they're going to take their driving test, they are reading and studying their book very carefully. We think that is a critical piece, but we've been loose on that intentionally, because it's not a class. That's not what the DMV does. It is a test, and we think that it's really just an expansion of the existing pool of questions that are in there that are perhaps better tailored to somebody turning the age of 21, which is a different test than trying to teach 14-year-olds not to consume alcohol, not to drink and drive. It's really the more complex issue of, are you going to make a decision to drink and drive, and here's what happens if you do.
And I think that's great. I think what you need to do for the Finance Committee will be to outline exactly what that's going to cost and how you're going to do it, because I don't disagree. What I'm envisioning is all the questions that you ask at 14, you get a sampling of four, put all the questions you'd ask, and maybe a couple more. Maybe there's new information today that you wouldn't know that might get kids' attention. For example, what is the average cost of a DUI? Right. What kinds of professions are you prohibited from getting a license for with a DUI?
Precisely.
You can't get into medical school. You know, in most cases, you can't get into law school. You can't sit for the bar in some cases. You know, there are serious consequences that as a young person you don't recognize yet. So those are the kinds of questions I might think of. And then you would have a separate booklet. You'd have that drop-off point, and they would be reading the book. And then when they go in to take the test, it would just be, rather than just four, it would be all on alcohol.
Precisely.
And Representative Roses wants to testify on your bill. No, he doesn't. He's just nodding. Okay. All right. So, yes, Senator Green.
Is this the correct model
for
a minor's license and an adult license?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Sure. Senator Bunny?
Yeah, just regarding that illustration you've shared with us with the ID theft and the fact that we don't have a law against it yet, I'd make sure you shredded these with your driver's license number on it. It's very useful to some people.
Wow.
Thank you.
Maybe it's not real.
Okay, so anybody else? I see one other person I want to really quickly get to. Bob Roses, because they have floor session. So just if you could, Shirley Marshall in Toke, if you could just be as brief as you can.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Shirley Marshall. I live in Toke, Alaska. I'm a registered voter, and I have teenage grandchildren in Toke. I support House Bill 75, and this is why. In Alaska, a 14-year-old qualifies to get a learner's permit, which requires the person to have a written test, which includes five or more questions about alcohol laws, and no driving test. Then, when the person turns 16, the license can be turned in to receive a permanent license, with the person taking a driver's test only, no written test.
That's right.
Then, 5 years later, at 21, the driver renews their license with no written or driving test. I feel a written test regarding current alcohol awareness laws is a great idea when turning 21, since it was 7 years since a written test was given.
Thank you very much, Shirley. That's very succinct, wonderful testimony. Any questions for Shirley? Okay, hearing and seeing none. Is there anybody else in the audience that wishes to testify on, what is it? House Bill 75. Anybody online I've overlooked? Okay, hearing and seeing none, that brings House Bill 75 back before us. Is there a motion to move it on to finance? Senator Stevens.
Madam President, I move to move House Bill 75 on to finance with attached fiscal note and individual recommendations.
Okay, so House Bill number 75 has moved. Thank you, Representative Ramirez, and all the folks that have testified. Okay, Bob Rosas, Representative Rosas, we'll get your bill up here. This is a quick bill, and then we'll end with Senator Ellis's bill and the wrap up on the testimony there. Welcome. Thanks for being so patient. My goodness, your bill came over last, so we stuck it at the bottom, and I'm sorry you had to listen through everything.
I appreciate that very much. Thank you, Madam Chair, and the members of the committee. And patience was not a problem. I taught school for 20 years. If you don't have any patience, you get out of that profession
good
quickly.
Good point.
So I appreciate you hearing the bill today. I am going to turn the testimony over to my very capable staff, Josh Appleby, and also working with Josh on this is Pat Carter. Some of you know him as being a lobbyist around the building on different issues. In this particular case, Pat is doing this pro bono. So he feels so strongly in what this bill accomplishes that he's taken it on. And also online, at least I hope we're able to make contact with him, would be Martin Boyer, who deals with this on a national level with all of the other states. And so I can assure you that this bill is in good hands with those three. And with that, I'm going to go and prepare myself for the floor session. So thank you very much for hearing the bill.
Thank you, Representative Rosas. We appreciate it. Okay, Mr. Appleby, tell us about House Bill 184. And we do have Martin Boyer and, again, Dwayne Vanek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 184. What it does is it brings the Support Our Troop commemorative license plate to Alaska. The plate, as we've seen before in previous bills, has an additional fee to the regular registration fee. It'd be collected and then may be appropriated by the legislature to Support Our Troops for redistribution in Alaska. Support Our Troops Incorporated will establish an Alaska Disbursement Board with the sole purpose of determining the best manner in which to disperse these funds. The local control is an essential part of this bill, in that the funds gathered, raised from the sale of the plate, will be spent in the state of Alaska. Support Our Troops started the process of issuing these official Support Our Troop plates in some 39 states. About 20 have already been completed, and the necessaries are in place for about 12 other states this year, and 7 more are in the planning stages for next year. We believe that Support Our Troops is one of the safest national charities, with checks and balances that have been put in place to ensure that there's accurate collection and disbursement of these funds to where they need to go, and they do that through the local disbursement boards. We also believe that this is an excellent example of self-taxation. So the people who want to donate to the charity are the people who get these plates, and they know that the fee is going towards supporting the troops and supporting the troops in the state of Alaska. And that covers sections 3 and 5 of the bill. Sections 1, 2, 4, 6, 7, 8, and 9 were sections that were added throughout the committee process. I've outlined those changes in a sheet included in your committee packet entitled Changes from CS for House Bill 184, Military and Veterans Affairs, to House Bill 184, Finance. And these sections incorporate different changes that allow the DMV to become more consumer friendly. For example, disabled veterans are entitled to a waiver of the fee for their plate, but right now they're required to get a plate with the international symbol for a disability, and some veterans don't want that. So we provided some language changes to allow them to do that, as well as some seniors over the age of 65. We've also included some changes for the DMV to use a more current address. Currently in statute, if they're going to send you a notice, they have to use the address on your driver's license, even though they might have access to a better address.
Good.
And so all of those changes, as outlined on that sheet, were with the support of Dwayne Bannock and the DMV, and they've been through the committee process before and never quite made it, but they found their way onto this bill. As Representative Rose has stated, we have Pat Carter here, the local representative for Support Our Troops, and online Martin Boyer, the executive director of Support Our Troops Incorporated, and Dwayne Bannock, a nice triumvirate of people to help answer any questions and to get to the bottom of what it is this bill actually accomplishes.
Wonderful. Thank you, Mr. Appleby. Questions from the committee? Okay. Senator Bundy.
We have an amendment.
We do have an amendment. What I thought I'd do before we do that is just get to the folks online, let them testify, and then we'll just bring it back before us for committee work. So any general questions? Or did you want to ask his opinion on the amendment? He's aware of it.
Necessary.
Mr. Appleby, do you want to provide an opinion on the amendment?
Absolutely. In House Finance, we altered some language in the bill, and we used the term solely for the purpose of providing benefits within the state of Alaska. And Pam Finley from our legal department has brought up an issue that might be a problem constitutionally. It really walks the line of creating a dedicated fund, which, as we all know, is a no-no in the state. And so we provided some language to change that. Additionally, the Support Our Troops Incorporated has a copyright on the term Support Our Troops, and there is a language change that just makes sure that when we're designing the plate and we're using that term, that we recognize that they own that copyright. And so we insert language that basically says approves the use in the terms of Support Our Troops.
Okay. Does that answer your question, Senator Bundy? Okay, and so we do have Mr. Martin Boyer from the Support Our Troops, Inc. online. Are you there, Mr. Boyer?
Yes, Madam Chairman.
If you want to go ahead and just state your name and affiliation and offer your testimony, we'd be glad to hear it.
Yes, I am Martin Boyer. Last name is spelled B-O-I-R-E, and I am chairman of Support Our Troops, Inc., which is a nationwide 501c3 nonprofit that works for the troops and particularly their families. The license plate is a simple means by which we civilians can honor our moral obligation to our neighbors. It simply facilitates us being able to look out for their families while they are deployed to look after our families, whether it's for a hurricane, a natural disaster, a peacekeeping mission, a war, whatever. It lets us own up to our moral obligation and step into the parents' shoes and start to do some things while they're gone. And I would like to sincerely thank Representative Bob Roses for carrying the bill and Senate Majority Leader Gary Stevens for helping us on the Senate side and with today's amendment, and in particular our local leader Pat Carter, without whom we would not have made it this far. And I can answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Boyer. I had a great conversation yesterday with Pat about all of your heartfelt compassion, and you know, instead of just sitting back and thinking about your feelings, putting it into action. And I was sharing with him that I had some very similar emotions, have had throughout this last year, thinking and talking with a lot of the families who have the bread earner in their family with an extended tour of duty over in Iraq, and the great difficulty that causes. And in one case, it's a young family that just gave birth to twins on top of their two other children. And so you can see the kind of real desperation that can bring to a family that was counting on the breadwinner being back, and well, never going in the first place, but certainly coming back after the tour of duty and having that extended. And they're serving us, serving our country, keeping our lives safe and free. And so I just really want to commend you personally for stepping up to the plate and doing something.
Thank you, ma'am.
So questions for Mr. Boyer? Okay, hearing and seeing none. Thank you, Mr. Boyer. And Dwayne Bannock is the only other person that I have online. Dwayne, did you want to offer any testimony, or are you just there to answer questions?
Madam Chairman, I would tell you that the Division of Motor Vehicles is cheerfully supporting this bill, and we'd be pleased to answer any questions if we may.
Wonderful. Can I ask you a question just real quickly? I can't help but think about the Donate a Dollar program we set up for anatomical gift donations. Is that working?
Madam Chair, it's halfway working. I say it's halfway working because we are with the Division of Motor Vehicles, and the staff here is doing a terrific job of asking for that and collecting it. The part that the state is not doing as well, quite frankly, as I think we should, is what we do with that money.
So is it going, my apologies to divert, but I just can't help but ask, so is it going back to the anatomical gift awareness program?
No, Madam Chair, it's not going anywhere.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, so what do we need to do to make that happen?
I believe we need legislation to direct that money somewhere.
Okay, so and the reason I thought about it is this unique funding mechanism that's set up in this bill to try to make sure this money gets to these folks. So instantaneously I thought of the bill that I did that allowed folks, if they wanted, voluntarily to check a donated dollar to help promote anatomical donation. And then I thought, well, I hope this works. So is there something we're doing here that works better than what we did in the other bill?
Madam Chair, you and I think very much along the same lines, and we've spent a lot of time on the discussion of that particular point. And as you know, only the legislature has the appropriation ability, and I believe that this section, the way this is written, definitely does work for this, and we are hopeful that legislation could be forthcoming that would amend the Anatomical Gift Awareness Fund in a similar fashion.
Now let me ask you a question. It's already been Christmas treed to death, but is there a simple sentence that we could put in here that would accommodate that goal? I don't think it's controversial. It's just getting anatomical gift money to the folks that are promoting that rather than sitting in the fund. Is there a one-liner?
Madam Chair, forgive me because I hadn't, I wasn't prepared for that. And if, with the indulgence of the committee and with the indulgence of the bill sponsor, I would love the opportunity to pursue that further.
Okay, let me ask the bill's sponsor because they don't want to hold it up. Would you be amenable if I could get that worked and it was not controversial to have a floor amendment? Okay. So, Dwayne, if you could work as quickly as you can to get that to my staff. I just slipped a note to Shalon this morning, and I said, this is a brilliant way to do it. And we, if you remember, we spent so much trying to figure that out to get around the dedicated appropriations provision. So if you could figure that out and let me know, and I don't want to hold the bill up. So in good faith, I'll advance it for today and work with you.
It'll be my number one priority today, ma'am. Thank you.
Thank you, Dwayne. Okay, wonderful. Further questions? Senator Green.
Was Section 9 one of those sections added in the process?
Through the chair, yes, Senator Green. It was added in House Finance.
If I could ask another question,
yes,
please.
Senator Green.
There's that legislation that was passed yesterday in the Senate, which had to do with the accumulation of X number of dollars of fines, you know, allowed for. Does this duplicate that?
Through the chair, I don't believe it duplicates that. I believe that this language just adds the cost of towing to the when they total up, when you commit a crime, then when they tow your car, they want to be able to get that money back. And currently, it's not part of the calculation. This adds it to it.
And actually, Dwayne, are you on the line? I think the scoff law bill that we passed, it does not incorporate 28, 330, 331, and 330. I think these aren't these alcohol-related crimes?
Madam Chairman, you're 100% correct.
Yeah, so this is a separate provision. This is because in the scoff law bill that we passed, that did delineate that towing is part of that already. So it's a separate provision. But this would change or at least clarify that for these alcohol-related crimes, when the vehicle is impounded, that the person who committed the crime will pay the cost of towing.
Well, I guess, Madam Chair, my question is, why does line 9 say, is amended by adding a new section to read? And then it looks like something's just been amended.
Can you answer that? I'm looking here quickly. Jeez.
Is that what you're looking at?
Yeah. So it's municipal. Oh no, passed already. Let's take a brief at ease. Apologies. Any further discussion? We're going to set House Bill 184. We're going to recess to the side and set it, recess to the call of the chair and set the bill aside to work on Section 2840080. Just a technical point, though. So if there's any further substantive testimony on 184, I'd like to hear that now, because when we bring it back up, it'll just be technical. There is an amendment. So anybody here in the audience on 184? Anybody online? Okay, hearing and seeing none, public testimony is closed. Bringing the bill back before us, let's go ahead and offer Senator Green.
I move amendment number one.
And okay.
That was made necessary, as Josh said, by use of the word solely, which might cause some dedicated fund problems.
Okay, is there an objection to amendment number one? Okay, seeing none, amendment number one carries. Okay, so the bill as amended, we'll just set it aside. I'll recess to the call of the chair. You can work with Shalon, Josh. Tell us when you're ready. Okay, that brings Senator Ellis back up. We had set his bill aside, which is the matter of Senate Bill number 141.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I listened very carefully to the concerns of the committee, and I appreciate those. I'm not sure everyone was here when I commented that in the previous iteration of this idea with Senator Cowdery, I co-sponsored his bill, and we everyone agree. I know of no opposition to the idea that young people would benefit, and our state as a whole would benefit from CPR and first aid training. Everybody thinks that's a great idea, and just the mechanism for making that happen in the future. Previously, we chose the idea of having that as required in our public schools. And there was a great deal of opposition to that, unfunded mandates. The school districts resisted that idea, though everyone agreed that the education was important and a positive thing. And so this iteration of the idea is the requirement that young people, first-time applicants for driver's licenses in the state of Alaska, have this training. It is my understanding that this training is available for free online. There are pay courses, there are free courses online, there are community courses that are free, there are community courses offered that have a nominal fee. So I believe, and you know, it depends on where you are in the state, absolutely. Senator French had a good point about different places and where the courses are offered, but everybody can go to a public library or a school library and take online courses. So I am confident that there is good access to cheap or inexpensive or free training courses across to every young person in the state. So anyway, I guess that those are my remarks, though I appreciate folks being concerned about exactly what we're doing here. My understanding is that the expert that we wanted to call in is may or may not be with us, but there's someone here in the room who's been briefed, if not.
Okay. I think she is. Suzanne Meunier. Suzanne, are you there?
I am.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you so much. If you could go ahead and state your name and your affiliation and tell us a little bit about the CPR courses.
Certainly. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Suzanne Meunier, and I represent the American Heart Association. I did have some very brief testimony prepared that incorporated a survivor story testimony who wanted to be with us but could not. She's teaching this morning. I understand, in the interest of time, that it may be better to just address questions from your committee, unless you prefer for me to read the woman's testimony and offer some remarks to that.
Senator Ellis, what do you think?
Well, if you could just if you could sum up the survivor story rather than reading it, and please do give some brief testimony on the bill, and then there may be questions.
Okay. Senator Ellis, thank you through the chair, Madam Chairman. Again, I'm Suzanne from the Heart Association, and would first like to just comment the fact that every year in America, sudden cardiac arrest claimed the lives of 325,000 Americans before they reached the hospital, and nearly 80% of cardiac arrests occur at home, and they're witnessed by a family member. Less than 7% of cardiac arrest victims survive. This is because the vast majority of those witnessing the arrest are people who do not know how to perform CPR, and yet effective bystander CPR provided immediately after a cardiac arrest can double a victim's chance of survival. Lydia Stevens is a woman from Anchorage who about 17 months ago was waiting for the school bus at Airport Heights Elementary in Anchorage, where she worked, for her students to arrive. She's a teacher's assistant. And she doesn't recall, but had been told that she fell. She was unconscious. Her coworkers immediately went into action, activated, called 911. The school nurse, Pat Brown, administered CPR for about 8 minutes, I've been told, before the fire department arrived. And I believe in your packets you have a letter of support for this bill from the Anchorage Fire Department. And the battalion chief who wrote that letter to your committee, Madam Chair, happened, interestingly, we found out as we talked about the story, that he was there in the rescue. Lydia was in Alaska Regional Hospital for 10 days. She is incredibly amazing to talk to. She was back in her classroom right after the Christmas break. Her event took place on the beginning of December 2005. And she certainly has asked me to forward her story and let the committee know that she supports Senate Bill 151 so lives like hers in Alaska can be saved. Given that statistic of less than 7% of people surviving, it's rather amazing. Certainly, passage of Senate Bill 151 will significantly increase the number of Alaskans who are trained and prepared to respond to cardiac events or other life-threatening emergencies. So the American Heart Association respectfully urges you, Madam Chair, and your committee to swiftly advance this important legislation, and I certainly am happy to address any questions your committee had, and I'm sorry that I was not able to be connected online, so I may have to hear those questions again.
Okay, questions for Ms. Suzanne Mounier. Senator Bundy.
Thank you. I remember reading several years ago that Seattle had the interesting label of the best city in America to have a heart attack because many of their population had learned CPR. Do you have information on that? Has that continued? indeed, has that saved lives?
Senator Bundy, through the chair, I'm told that yes, our neighbors in Seattle are looked to throughout the country as the gold standard in saving lives, and that their survival rate, unlike that single digit that I reported, I believe is in excess of 30 or even 40%.
Thank you.
Okay, further questions? Senator Stevens.
Just on that point, my mother, having lived in Seattle, I paid attention to that, and what I remember reading was that they have such excellent ambulance service that anywhere you lived in Seattle, you could be immediately reached by an ambulance with a CPR-trained person. I'm not sure that the civilians were so well-trained. Maybe they were, but I think it was really the ambulance service that was so exceptional in Seattle.
Madam Chair, actually,
yeah.
It was
Bundy?
The civilians that I had read about, but again, that's been several years.
Mm. Madam
Senator
Chair,
Ellis?
Suzanne, thank you for being with us today. I appreciate you supporting the bill and your organization. There was legitimate concerns from members of the committee about the appropriateness of using the Division of Motor Vehicles and the requirement, for young people getting a driver's license to have a signature from their scout leader or the Red Cross or their parents that they had completed an online or a community course in first aid and CPR, the appropriateness of using this mechanism to ensure that. That was one senator's concern. And then there was another member's concern about the resistance of teenagers and young people to this requirement, the accumulated cost of the test and the training for driving, if they seek a private course, I guess, and the cost from the state, and then if they chose a pay course for first aid and CPR, the additional cost to that teenager or that family. So the aggravation and the accumulated cost, I guess, there. Can you help us think about that quickly? I know we're running out of time, but any comments about those things or weighing those against the public safety and education gain from the bill?
Senator Ellis, through the chair, certainly the opportunity to have a new generation of Alaskans prepared and trained in CPR and first aid will indeed increase the number of lives that are saved in Alaska from cardiac and other emergencies. There are currently online courses available for folks to take for CPR and first aid. They certainly, given, again, this generation coming forward, we know that this bill is aimed at kids. This is a group of people that are generally online multiple times every single day. We have some science that demonstrates that, of course, we know that people learn differently, and we have science to support the fact that actually online training can be a more effective way for some people to learn, and I wouldn't be surprised that with young people that may very well be the case. There's the opportunity with the online courses currently available to take what might normally take an 8 hours, on average seems to take between 1.5, maybe 2 hours, and the person that takes those courses has access to them for up to 6 months. At the completion of that course, they would receive a certificate. I'd also want to comment to say that the American Heart Association has talked with the Department of Motor Vehicles, and we remain ready and encouraged to partner with them and other stakeholders in assuring that the regulation language is adequate to meet the requirements of this bill, and I believe the effective date is set for January 08, so that gives us plenty of time to partner and work to ensure that we're offering opportunities that are easy, accessible to Alaskans as well as low cost.
Madam Chair, just finally, and thank you for letting me pose this, and I hope I was fair in summing up some of the concerns of the members. Suzanne, it's clear to me, would you confirm, or do you think that it's if this requirement were to become law and young people were required to get this training and have the sign-off, do you think it would increase the availability of community classes from different groups, the Boy Scouts and churches and your organization as well, in providing additional training opportunities across the state?
Well, certainly the American Heart Association is always looking for innovative ways to train more people with the life-saving skills of CPR, and so I can certainly imagine that more opportunities for community training would be sought as a result of legislation like this, and I would imagine that would be true for other organizations in Alaska as well.
Thank you.
Okay, and we do have one last person online. Senator Stevens had a question first, and then Uwe Kalinka is on the line.
Well, I was just, thank you, Madam Chair, just responding to Suzanne's comments. I mean, that's quite an assumption you're making, that that everyone has access to the Internet and that classes will be taught around the state. I mean, we're talking about some pretty small communities, and we're talking about some people that may not have access to the Internet. I mean, you don't know that unless you have some information to share with us on every young person having access to the Internet, which I'd appreciate hearing if you have.
Senator Stevens, through the chair, certainly I don't have in front of me today, but I would be happy to provide to the committee the information that I have read and been aware of, that I think Alaska is one of the top states in the country as far as technology access, as far as number of Internet access per home, and I believe all of our schools in Alaska have Internet access as well, and someone mentioned the libraries. So those, I would think that, and we can certainly provide that to the committee, that we are able through technology to deliver this throughout Alaska, and particularly the small communities in rural Alaska. Additionally, there are very low-cost materials available from the American Heart Association, and I would imagine other organizations, for print materials for the training as well. Low-cost meaning even less than $5.
Okay. Uwe Kalinka. Mr. Kalinka, are you there?
Yes, good afternoon, Madam Chair, and ladies and gentlemen. This is Uwe Kalinka here. I'm presently, unfortunately, on the East Coast, and I'm unable to be there in person. However, as you all know, this bill that Mr. Senator Ellis was rather gracious to introduce on my behalf, so to speak, I'd like to thank him. I'm sorry for the ringing in the background. And this bill, of course, is very important to me personally. What I have is, unfortunately, not a very happy ending story. As I'm sure you all know, approximately 4 years ago, my son was murdered at Taco Bell, less than a mile from the fire station, less than a mile from the hospital he was born in. The fatal wound He received multiple stab wounds in the legs, but the fatal wound was right behind the knee. And the unfortunate thing about this whole situation is that if somebody would have known how to put on a tourniquet on his leg, he would be alive today. Unfortunately, in the school, in his health classes, he was taught how to put on condoms, but not how to put on a tourniquet, which is one of the simplest things in the world. Therefore, I urge you to please pass this bill along so it can become law, because if it only saves one life, it's worth it. Mm-hmm. And up in Alaska, as you all know, a hospital can be a long, long way away. And just think about it, less than a mile from the next EMT, less than a mile from the hospital. And once again, I urge you, please, to pass this along. This is in the interest of the public, and I don't know what else to say.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Mr. Klinka, and we were all very sad for your family's loss and appreciate your testimony today. Are there any questions for Mr. Klinka? Okay, so anyone else here in the audience? Again, I've opened it back up for public testimony on 151. Anyone online I've overlooked? Okay, so hearing and seeing none, it brings 151 back before us for committee discussion. Any discussion?
Madam Chair.
Senator Stevens?
I appreciate the heartfelt comments we've heard. I would like to be of support to Senator Ellis in this, but you know, I just have some serious qualms about it. There seems to be a lack of consistency. Maybe when I voted for something in which we've changed the driver's license for alcohol, but alcohol is directly related to driving. CPR is not. You're not a better driver if you have CPR. And after all, we're doing is giving out a driver's license. I'm just concerned first about how this matter is going to be available to everyone in the state. I'm not sure that that's really true. I mean, it's a nice comment that Suzanne has made, but when I think of villages like Old Harbor, I don't know that that would be available there, the classes there. I guess, and I think of my own self, I had to take a class in CPR, but I have to tell you, Senator, if you had a heart attack, I would be hard-pressed to know what to do right here. It was years and years ago, and so I'm not sure I'd be of any value, but I hope someone else in the room could know what to do. So, because we forget very quickly. I mean, we just heard that in 6 months people forget what they're supposed to do. So, yeah, I guess I'm just, my problem is seeing that there's a direct connection between CPR and a driver's license. And it seems to me the place for this to happen is in the schools. That's where we should be teaching kids to know CPR and first aid, in the schools. That's where it should happen. I know you've run into a roadblock on that issue, but to take the other approach and say, no, you can't have your driver's license unless you have CPR, it seems unnecessarily cost, time consumption, and imposition on young people that I'm not really sure. I guess I don't see the logic of the thing, and that's just where I am.
Okay. Senator Bundy?
Thank you. When Senator Stevens mentioned rural Alaska, I started thinking about the level of drowning deaths, the lack of medical emergency personnel out there compared to the Seattle ambulance and that sort of thing. And while this may not be the perfect mechanism to get there, it is one of the most universal. And I would like Anchorage to emulate Seattle and having many of its people trained in CPR, but perhaps for Alaska, more importantly, when a mile from any road we are beyond immediate medical care, we may serve our citizens well by encouraging young people and even at my advanced age and having I can't remember taking an official class, but having read about CPR, trust me, if you have a heart attack, if you want to give me a chance to practice, I will practice on you.
Yeah.
So, it's
a choice. Something's better than nothing. Further comments? Is there a motion? Senator Bundy, you want to make a motion?
Yes, I would move that we move Senate Bill 151 from committee with individual recommendations attached. Fiscal note.
Okay, the motion's there. Is there an objection?
Object.
Okay, Senator Stevens objects. Madam Secretary, we call the roll. Fair.
Yep. Senator Bundy?
Senator Stephen?
No.
Senator Bending?
Yes.
Senator Green?
No.
Senator French?
Yes.
Chair McGuire?
Yes. Okay, you've got your work cut out for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've heard the concerns. I will take them to heart and work with members to try and address those. And I appreciate your attention today.
Okay. We didn't hold it up, but I think you know where your problem areas are.
Okay.
So
we'll work on it.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Ellis. All right. We're going to go ahead and recess to the call of the chair. The Senate State Affairs Committee is called back to order after a recess. It's 4:25, still the 10th of May, and we do have a quorum to conduct business consisting of President Green, Senator French, and myself, McGuire. And we have one amendment before the committee, which will be labeled. Have we already amended this? So this will be amendment two?
Mm-hmm.
This is amendment number two, and it is L.3 by Luckup. And this amendment, I'll move amendment number two, and then you want to object and I'll explain it.
I'll object just for explanation.
Okay. So what this amendment does is it addresses the problem that I brought up in our earlier meeting today, which is that we did the anatomical gift donation bill, and we set up a donated dollar by which the public could elect voluntarily to donate a dollar to go to organ donor awareness. And what happened was I couldn't figure out a mechanism by which to get that money back around again. So we just let it go through thinking we could resolve it later. And the brilliant Josh Appleby came up with a strategy to do just that thing within this bill. And so in page one, line three, it deletes, and then the other thing it does is it deletes a reference to subsection 9 on the towing. So it does two things, and I've looked through it, and I think it does it well.
I withdraw my objection.
Okay. Is there further objection to amendment number two?
Just
for Senator French.
Thank you for the record, Madam Chair. The reason we're taking out section 9 is...
The reason we're taking out Section 9 is because there would be a single subject violation to keep it all in. So
with the addition of,
yes.
of anatomical gifts,
yes.
we push out insurance.
Yes. We push out the cost of towing. That's all it did. The cost of towing and storage.
Well, no.
Yeah.
Don't mean to interrupt, but as I recall, we were looking.
Yes.
This is a new section.
Yeah, we were trying to find it in the statute,
right.
And
so 2840.080 is not on the books anywhere.
No,
we were adding that.
Right.
So we won't have a provision for impoundment of motor vehicles and persons arrested for.
Unless you can fit it in the crime package.
Oh, that's an idea. That's an idea in HB 90. Good thinking. Yep, we'll take a look at that. But I can see. I'll go from there.
There are some fish bills out there too, I see. And I don't know.
You sold me, Bill.
Yeah, boy. Okay, so yes, so that's what that does. And so the intent is to set up the fund the same way the Support Our Troops fund will be set up. And again, the concept is to further the public's will in this, is that when they give money for a license plate or they donate a dollar for a cause, you want to make sure that it goes to the cause that they're asking it to, or else that's, you know, that's misrepresenting what we're doing. So okay, so if the objection is withdrawn, is there further objection to amendment number two? Okay, so that brings the bill back before us as amended. Is there further committee discussion? Mm-hmm. Questions? Okay, is there a motion?
Madam Chairman, I would move House Bill 184 as amended out of committee with individual recommendations.
Okay, and then is there an objection to that motion? Okay, hearing and seeing none, then I need a motion on the Senate concurrent resolution to be numbered.
I would
the conforming
move the
title.
Title change resolution along to move along with the bill.
Okay, any objection to the title resolution moving along with the bill? Okay, hearing and seeing none, then both the title resolution and House Bill 184 as amended have moved, and we're adjourned. Ta-da!